This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is America on the Road, named Best Radio Show by the International Automotive Media Conference, and now in its 30th year on the air. Thanks for being with us as we bring you the latest automotive information from around the world. I'm Jack Nerad. With me is co-host Chris Teague. Chris, good to see you. Good to talk with you.
Good to see you as well. How are things on your side of the world?
I think things are going okay. You know, you never know, but so far so good today. We got a lot of news to talk about, Chris, leading the news this week, and this is kind of frightening, actually. A Tesla factory has been the victim of sabotage. I'll give you the details on that and Elon Musk's interesting reaction, maybe a tone-deaf reaction coming up. I'll talk about that a little bit, as you will. The most recent sales numbers are in from across the industry, and one vehicle type has grabbed all the headlines. It's probably not what you might think either. We'll tell you what's hot and what's not coming up. And Honda has just pulled the wraps off a fascinating new version of the CR-V small SUV. It combines a hydrogen fuel cell with battery electric power. And we'll have details for you coming up. So a lot to talk about, right, Chris?
Yeah, a lot of exciting news. Can't wait to get into it.
Yeah. Well, let's do a little business here. America on the Road is brought to you by DrivingToday.com, EMLancey.com, the publisher of my latest book, Dance in the Dark, and, of course, Mercury Insurance. If you're looking to save some money, you should switch to Mercury for your auto and home insurance. Californians save an average of $670 with Mercury, so imagine how much you could save. Get a quote today at DrivingToday.com/auto insurance. That's DrivingToday.com/auto insurance. Insurance. You need that hyphen in there. Otherwise, it just won't work. Well, as you longtime listeners to the show know, Chris lives at one end of the country. I live at the other. Each week, we get together to talk about cars, the car industry, and how you can save some money on your car. And of course, we also road test a couple of vehicles each week. What is your road test vehicle, Chris?
I spent the week behind the wheel of the 2024 Buick Envista. It's an all-new model for this year, and I can't wait to tell you all about it.
Yeah, fascinating. We'll learn a lot when you tell me about that. I'll be road testing the 2024 Honda Accord, the touring version, always one of the best values among mid-sized cars, and it's now offered in hybrid version, so we'll take a look at that. And this week, our special guest is Rebecca Lindland. She is Director of Insights at Cars Commerce, a longtime industry observer, analyst. I've known her for years and years and years, and we'll talk about hot topics. So a lot for you in this week's show. Stay with us on America on the Road, and we'll be right back with all that and a whole lot more. Thanks for being with us and stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to America on the Road with Chris Teague. Jack Nerad back with you. We're so glad you're with us. We really do appreciate you being with us on America on the Road. And interesting news, a kind of fascinating, almost frightening news from Tesla this time around. The Tesla Gigafactory in Germany has been the victim of sabotage, arson, I think. Strange story here. Elon Musk called this extremely dumb. I'd say a lot worse than that. And why he called it extremely dumb is even weirder, but first, we should tell you about the attack itself. I mean, this was electrical outage. Apparently, there was a group, at least, that claimed responsibility for this that launched an attack on, I guess they were trying to attack Tesla and Elon Musk, kind of protest them. Apparently, a far-left organization, at least that's how it's described. But what it has done is put a lot of people out of work for a few days, clobbered the value of Tesla's stock, and just done a lot of bad things. I mean, what are your thoughts on this before we get into what Elon Musk had to say about it?
Well, after having written the story about this earlier today, as I understand it, they were protesting the expansion of the Gigafactory into a forest nearby, and that would require some clear cutting and changes to the the local ecosystem there. But I think if you're going to protest a car company, you know, love or hate Tesla, there are a lot worse car companies that you could be protesting. Even in Europe, I mean, there's the Scania truck company probably right down the street making big diesel trucks that they could be looking at too. And I mean, and Tesla even promised to replant the trees and reduce its water usage and all this stuff. But you know, I think I agree with Musk on this one. It does seem a little dumb. I'm just going to say that.
Yeah, I mean, this is the quote, I think. Stopping production, this is Elon Musk, stopping production of electric vehicles rather than fossil fuel vehicles is extremely dumb. Or he used the German term for extremely dumb, which is extrem dumb. What bothers me about this is it's almost inviting sabotage on fossil fuel vehicle plants, right? I mean, why would you do that? That just seems kind of tone deaf to me. I mean, none of us wants any kind of sabotage at all. I don't think. I think there are plenty of non-violent, non-invasive ways to protest things. So cutting off electricity, not only to the plant, but to the surrounding neighborhood and all the people involved in that, I mean, who knows? I mean, this could have had, you know, potentially life-threatening effects depending on, you know, who's depending on electricity in that neighborhood. It just seems like a really bad idea, no matter what your political stripe.
Yeah, I mean, this is a little more destructive than some of the other protest methods we've seen in Europe. You know, this Europe is full of people gluing themselves to highways and throwing paint on you know, neoclassical paintings and things in museums.
Yeah. So soup. I like throwing soup on paintings. That's a great,
yeah, there you
great
go.
Way of protesting.
I mean, these are not, I mean, maybe your point is heard, but these are not ways to influence people and make friends, I don't think, to get people on your side. So, and especially as you mentioned, this could have been life-threatening if someone's on life support or some sort of other medical devices and the power goes out, that could be a problem.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it will cost Tesla some money. You know, maybe they're not so sad that production was halted for a couple of days because sales have been a bit slower than they expected. But that happened in Germany. Happily, it did not happen in the United States. What has happened in the United States is we have sales numbers for the most recent month and a pretty strong month for the auto industry overall. And the vehicle type that seemed to be among the strongest, maybe the strongest, were hybrids, not electric vehicles, not plug-in hybrids necessarily, although plug-in hybrids probably figured in here, but just generally hybrids are doing quite well. And I think some of that, Chris, and maybe you'll agree with me, is just the fact that a lot of vehicles, including the vehicle I'm going to road test in this show, their top model is a hybrid. You can't get the top model without a hybrid engine. And I think what we're seeing is essentially the mainstreaming of hybrid power, which I think makes a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, I agree, Jack. You know, we've gone from the days of sort of the pokey left lane Prius clogging up the highway to hybrids being actually enjoyable, more so in many cases than their gas counterparts to drive. And the prices are right when you look at them compared to electric vehicles. So you get, you know, the fuel economy benefit on one side, and you're not paying for a full electric vehicle on the other. And they're easier to find, I think, too. So, you know, there are a lot of reasons that this is making sense to me. But I think if you're Toyota, you're probably sitting back thinking, man, I was right.
Yeah. Well, Toyota's been right about a lot of things for a lot of years, haven't they, when it comes to the car industry? And I think they were spot on here. What's kind of fascinating to me, too, is they're seeing some of their rivals like Honda, I already mentioned, you know, jumping on the hybrid bandwagon when they had not been big proponents of hybrids before, and it doing very well. Another company that's doing pretty well with its hybrids is Ford Motor Company, which is not really known for its hybrids and has put all its publicity behind its electric vehicles like the Ford F-150 Lightning and, you know, those vehicles. Interesting to me, you know, Mustang Mach-E, interesting to me that it's the hybrid vehicles that are doing quite well.
Yeah, I mean, these are, like I said, I still think I'm stuck in this thought of it's the best of both worlds. I mean, you're not getting rid of gas completely, and then you're also not paying for an EV. But from Ford's perspective, you know, the Mustang Mach-E is maybe not quite as compelling as some other others in the segment, and then the F-150 Lightning is still very expensive. So I could see where things like the Escape Hybrid and the F-150 Hybrid come into play in a big way there.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing hybrid trucks. You make a good point. The hybridization of full-size pickup trucks, you know, Toyota does that as well, has been a boon, I think. I mean, you're getting much better fuel economy. It's not eye-popping because, you know, they're big trucks, but it's significantly better than what we have seen. And again, you have that instant power that you get from a lot of these hybrids, I think it makes just really good sense.
Yeah, for a pickup truck, you can move from a V8 to a V6 and probably actually gain torque by adding the electric motor in there. So
right.
It does make sense.
Gain torque, gain drivability because of that torque too. This is a fascinating story to me too, and I'm sure you've been following this, Chris, is this Honda CR-V hydrogen fuel cell vehicle combined with electric. It's essentially, I guess you could call it a hydrogen hybrid, hydrogen-powered hybrid, and it'll go on sale, or at least be able to be leased as a 2025 model year vehicle. It is the Honda CR-V EFCEV, which is a lot of letters, and we won't say that over and over again. But I think very interesting vehicle here. What's your overall take?
I think it is very interesting. I think the complexity worries me. But again, this is Honda, not like, you know, not Yugo or some other, you know, random automaker. But it will be interesting to see. You know, hydrogen is very limited, as we've talked about this a few times. It's only available maybe in your neighborhood and a couple of others in California. So it will be interesting to see if that begins to sort of creep its way across the country. But again, infrastructure is going to be a problem for these vehicles if they decide to expand past California. So, but the first plug-in hybrid hydrogen vehicle is definitely worth, I think, looking at it, if not maybe celebrating, because we're still delivering, you know, more alternative fuels and different ways to look at it.
Yeah. One of the cautionary flags, I guess you'd call it a yellow flag, not a red flag here, is its range, 270 miles. As you say, when you're going on hydrogen, which is very, very difficult to find, having limited range like that and having to go back to the hydrogen station over and over again after less than 300 miles of driving, that's not terrific. On electric power, it will go 29 miles on pure electric power. Interestingly, the fuel cell modules are a joint venture between General Motors and Honda. They've joined forces on the Honda Prologue electric car as well. So that's kind of strange bedfellows in a way. But I'm eager to drive this thing and see what it's all about.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see how it drives. I was just thinking, as you were saying, that people can install hydrogen charging stations or fueling stations at their homes. So it won't be like owning an EV where you could theoretically charge at home if you have a driveway. So.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with hydrogen because, of course, it's difficult to come by and it is not, it has to be derived from stuff, right? I mean, there's not free hydrogen. You can't drill a hole in the ground and pull up hydrogen. Transporting hydrogen is difficult. I think there's a lot of challenges to this, but the good thing about it is refueling is just like filling up a gasoline car. I mean, you can do it that quickly and essentially that painlessly. So I think there's a lot to like about that.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, when we come back, we'll be road testing some pretty cool vehicles. I think they're pretty cool. In fact, you were road testing a vehicle that had kind of fallen off my radar screen a little bit, but now you're putting it back on, the Buick Envista. And I'm going to be talking about the Honda Accord, a hybrid version, actually, of the Honda Accord. So stay with us for that, and we'll be back right here on America on the Road. So stay with us. We look forward to talking to you right after the break. Welcome back to America on the Road with Chris Teague, Jack Neerad back with you for road test time. And interesting vehicles this time around. One vehicle everybody's heard of, certainly, the Honda Accord. I mean, you must be living in a dark cave if you haven't heard of the Honda Accord. And there's a fairly new version of that I will be road testing. Chris, you're road testing a vehicle that a lot of people probably have not heard of from Buick. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this is a brand new model from Buick. I mean, it shares quite a bit of its underlying engineering with the Chevrolet Trax, but this is a new model from Buick. It's a 2024 Envista. Interestingly, Jack, and I'm going to give away the cat out of the bag here right at the beginning of this review. The price of this vehicle is my favorite part. I think looking at the ever-increasing transaction prices in the automotive industry, this one is a breath of fresh air. The preferred trim, which is the entry-level model, starts at $23,495 after destination. The Model I test is the mid-range sport touring, which came in at just over $25,000 after destination. And even if you go all the way to the very top of the Avenir trim, it's still under $30,000 to start. So you don't get all-wheel drive. You know, it's not the largest vehicle in the world. It's a subcompact crossover. But I think the value proposition here is very strong. So, Jack, have you driven the Envista?
I have not. I barely have heard of the Envista, to tell you the truth. I have not driven it. I know something about the Trax, certainly.
Yeah.
So I understand the market, but I have no experience to share here, really.
Okay. Well, you get a turbocharged 1.2 liter three-cylinder engine. My car has a three-cylinder engine. I'm never going to knock them again. I think they've come a long way from when we saw them many, many years ago. You get 137 horsepower, 162 pound-feet of torque, and a six-speed automatic transmission. So no CVT, continuously variable transmissions here. You get a legitimate six-speed, and as I mentioned, front-wheel drive. So 137 horsepower. It's not going to win any drag races, but the power delivery is smooth. It's direct. It's relatively quiet for a small engine and, you know, a small SUV, small crossover. And there's plenty of grunt, you know, highway and in-town driving. I never found any time where I was like, you know, kind of doing the video game head jerk while you're trying to get the car to go a little faster down the road. The handling is not the sharpest, but again, this is a Buick. We're not talking about like a BMW sporty SUV here. And the ride quality is pretty smooth for a subcompact. I mean, I didn't find a lot of things to complain about, even over the roads here. The plows destroy our roads in the wintertime. And even though we haven't had a lot of snow, the roads are still pretty bumpy. And this car just glides right over most of it without much of a complaint. The interior is very comfortable. My sport touring model came with synthetic leather upholstery. It felt nice enough. I would not, you know, look at it and think, wow, I feel like I got cheaped out on instead of full leather upholstery. The front buckets are nice. They're wide. They're deep. They're well supported and they're comfortable. I think this vehicle is more comfortable to me than the Trax. I think the seats have a little bit more padding. You know, the interior is not any bigger, but I think that, you know, the seats and the upholstery go a long way to making it feel nicer than the Chevy counterpart, which it should because it's a Buick. You get an 8-inch digital gauge cluster and an 11-inch touchscreen. I have to, like, give big praise to GM and Buick's infotainment software here. It's the same as in Chevy and GMC and to a degree in Cadillac, though they have kind of their own flavor. It's very easy to use. It's responsive. Unlike GM's electric vehicles, this vehicle does come with wireless Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, and they're very easy to figure out. Like, when I say that, I mean, you have a row of icons on the left side of the screen, and it's very simple to pick what you want while you're driving. There's no swiping and trying to get around the menus like in some others, and, you know, all around a good tech experience. Buick does equip quite a few driver assistance features. You get automatic emergency braking, lane departure warnings, all those good things. Mine came with the upgraded package, which added blind spot monitoring, adaptive cruise control, and rear cross traffic alerts, among a few other things. Jack, I think if I had to give a cap over or a recap of all this, I would say a couple of things. The price is right for me. The rear of this vehicle, it slopes quite heavily, so it looks great from the outside, but I think that does cut into cargo space a little bit. My large dog, he's cramped down almost to the extent that he is in the back of my Corolla. So I think, you know, there's some thought process that should be had there if you're going to look at hauling cargo in this thing. And the back seats are comfortable for kids. So you could definitely get away with a two-kid family in this thing if you're not going to, like I said, be hauling a lot of cargo or large dogs or things like that. But all around, you know, do I think this would be the vehicle for me? Probably not. I need more space. But again, the price is absolutely stellar on this thing. And it comes well equipped out of the box.
Yeah, interesting. And you don't think it's too small. I mean, Americans don't love small vehicles. This strikes me as a vehicle that's probably going to be in a single person household, or maybe a couple would have this as opposed to folks with kids, maybe infants or an infant. Sure. In the family. But what's your take on that?
I think I agree with that. I do think that there's something to be said about the maneuverability of this vehicle, especially in, I live in an old New England town. The streets are narrow. It's very hard to get in and out of places at times. And, you know, the vehicle held its own. Again, I would not try to haul an entire family plus a dog and gear and everything else. But for the most part, young families, as you mentioned, single people, I think it's a fantastic buy.
Yeah. And I think as an urban car in particular, as somebody who lives in a congested urban area like Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles, those kind of places, and particularly a good vehicle for them. So makes sense. Nice to see something affordable on the marketplace,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Well, I was driving the Honda Accord, and I had the touring version, and everybody knows about the Honda Accord, midsize sedan, a very, very popular midsize sedan. The interesting thing to me about the touring version is it's almost a separate vehicle in a way from the rest of the Accord line. I mean, it certainly has the same profile. It has the same interior space and trunk space and all of that. But they trick it up in various ways that make it a bit different. It is has a hybrid powertrain. That's the only way you can get the Touring. And it costs about close to $40,000. I think the base list is $38,890. So I think there's destination charge on top of that. But quite a good vehicle all the way around, as you might expect. And it's been fascinating to me to see Honda's about-face on hybrids, where they were not necessarily enthusiastic about hybrids, as they have been not necessarily enthusiastic about electric cars up till now. But they did change their mind about hybrids. And this has a two-motor hybrid system with a 2-liter four-cylinder engine, two electric motors, delivers 204 horsepower, so that's enough horsepower. It's an all-wheel drive vehicle. You cannot get an all-wheel It's a front-wheel drive vehicle. You cannot get all-wheel drive in the Accord, so which is just fine. Filled with safety equipment, it has Honda Sensing, which has a ton of stuff: forward collision warning, pedestrian detection, automatic emergency braking, etc., etc., etc. Before I go any farther with my blather here, what's your reaction to the new Accord overall?
I think they've done a good job positioning it. They said when they announced the car that the Touring model was their view that was their sort of easing people into electric vehicles, or electrification, I should say, not electric vehicles. And Honda's done a good job, as I said earlier, with making hybrids more fun to drive than the regular gas models. And the Accord, I drove one a few months ago, is always a fantastic, spacious car. So this all makes great sense for the next Accord buyer as they step up through the ranks, I should say.
Talk about spaciousness. I mean, the front seats are spacious, of course, and very accommodating. But I think what's really eye-popping is the rear seat area. I mean, three adults can actually sit back there pretty successfully. There's tons of legroom, almost limousine-like legroom in the back. You know, pretty impressive legroom there. So from that point of view, I don't think a lot of people use their back seats all that often, but it certainly does provide a lot of back seat room. One of the things that differentiates the Touring from every other Accord is its infotainment system. Which I find kind of interesting. It features the Google built-in infotainment system. It has Google Assistant, Google Maps. You can buy apps from the Google Play Store. All of that is good stuff. I wonder why they confine this really good infotainment system to strictly the Touring model. Others get a 7-inch touchscreen. This has a larger touchscreen and just better all around. 12-inch touchscreen and wireless Apple CarPlay, wireless Android Auto, Alexa compatibility. Actually, wireless Android Auto might be a little bit of a misnomer. I think in Google built-in cars, it's not exactly Android Auto, but you kind of tap directly into Google. We're seeing a lot of vehicles now with Google built-in in their infotainment systems. What's your overall reaction to those?
I think it's an easy way to add a ton of functionality without changing the way the interface looks drastically from previous model years. You know, Volvo did it, GM's done it, and their interface looks roughly the same, but it adds, you know, Google Voice Assistant, Google Play Store functionality. So you get a lot of stuff without a big change.
Yeah, good stuff. It has a 10.2-inch digital instrumentation display, which I like. I think those are kind of cool. And that's pretty much across the board. But the Touring has a head-up display as well. And I like head-up displays, although I have to admit, and maybe it's the Luddite in me or just many, many years of looking down at a speedometer. I continue to look down to see how fast I'm going, even though it's projected out there in front of the windshield and very easy for anyone to see. Do you do that, Chris?
I do. Even in my wife's car that has a head-up display, and my Corolla doesn't have it, but I find myself looking at both. So I try very hard to just look straight ahead of the head-up display.
Yeah. So this is a very comfortable car with a hybrid-style fuel economy, an estimated 48 miles per gallon combined, which is terrific. You got to like that. 44 miles per gallon in the Touring. The other hybrids get 48 miles per gallon combined. But, you know, that's darn good mileage for a vehicle this large. I just think it's a terrific value. I mean, 40 grand is a lot. I might opt for something other than the Touring that would come in the low 30s or something like that. But talking about affordable vehicles, as we have on the show fairly frequently lately, this is a good one from the affordability point of view, I think.
I agree.
Yeah. So two affordable vehicles this time around. You got to like that. Something you don't see all the time. And when we come back, we will have a terrific guest for you. Rebecca Lindland is Director of Insights at Cars Commerce. They're, of course, associated with cars.com. A longtime industry observer and analyst. So we'll be talking with her about what's going on in the industry. So stay with us for that, and we'll be right back right here on America on the Road. Welcome back, everybody, to America on the Road. Jackie Redd back with you, and we have a terrific guest, really terrific guest. That, you know, we have terrific guests for you every week, but this is a terrific, terrific guest because Rebecca Lindland is not only the Cars Commerce Auto Data and Insights Director, but she's a longtime veteran of this industry. I think a personal friend. I can certainly consider her a personal friend and just so knowledgeable about the industry. Rebecca, thanks so much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Jack, I was absolutely delighted. I consider you a personal friend, and I'm really privileged to say that because you have been a veteran of the industry as well, and I feel like we've grown up together.
Yeah, I grew up a lot sooner than you did, but that's nice of you to say. I mean, I've recently joined Cars.com after serving as an industry analyst. You did some public relations work for a car company for a while, all kinds of things. Give us some kind of sense of, you know, what you're doing for Cars.com.
Yes. So I have. It's you know, over the course of my 20-something career, the main focus has really been on analysis. And what that means is it's understanding the vehicles that are coming out, and it's understanding the people that may buy them. And so for Cars.com, I work really closely with our industry analysts that we have on staff. I'm working with our editorial team as well. You know, we have almost 29 million people that come to the site every month. It's some crazy number. And so we're able to extract a lot of insights from that information. And really, I think that our mission has always been to put the right car in the right driveway. You know, I think you and I both love cars, and we like people, and we like to match those things up. And so I always want people to be really excited about the purchase, you know, of a vehicle, whether new or used, it doesn't matter. I just want them to love it.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's the advice I give to people when they say what they should buy. I say, well, look for something you love. You know, you're going to spend a ton of money on this thing, and you're not going to gain much money on this. I can tell you that. You're probably going to lose some money. So for the money you spend, for the expense you have, might as well love it, right?
Absolutely. I always, you know, I drive an Alfa Romeo Stelvio named Sergio. And oftentimes when I park that vehicle, I'll look back at it. You know, I've had it for almost 3 years and I still look back at it. And I think about, you know, my parents were very happily married for decades. And, you know, my father still used to watch my mom come in and out of the room. And that type of love, you know, is something that maybe is not appropriate for a vehicle. But I still want that kind of emotional involvement in your second, you know, really what's probably your second largest purchase, unless you're buying some really fancy handbags.
Right. Well, and that's important to the industry, too, that people have that just desire to have, I mean, almost literal desire, a practically physical desire to have a new car. I mean, that's important to the industry and to getting things to turn over. Otherwise, we'd just be in transportation modules, and what fun would that be?
Yes, exactly. A quick personal story. I told my mother when I was about 10 years old that if I had all the money in the world, all I would buy is cars. And she was a little bit horrified.
That's worked out for you, though, hasn't it?
Exactly, it has.
Well, in analyzing the market, we've really seen the market kind of change under our feet over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. Certainly COVID had a big part in that. And, you know, kind of the gentrification in a lot of ways of the auto industry on the new car side. Talk about that a little bit. Am I right, number one? And if I am, then expand on that a little bit.
Yes, no, absolutely. We certainly have seen shifts in many different ways. And as you mentioned at the beginning, you know, I really spent the last 3 years working for a manufacturer, which was a very different environment. So I didn't necessarily get the opportunity to look at the industry overall, but since my time at cars.com in the last few weeks, or Cars Commerce is our official name, I think I really have started to look back at the impact of the pandemic. And one of the things that caught my attention as somebody that did a lot of forecasting was we're about 10 million units short on what new cars should be in the inventory, in new and used cars in particular. So sales fell by a combined 10.3 million units over the course of the pandemic, and they really haven't come back yet. And what that means is that we're running short on used car inventory, especially newer used car inventory. We're also certainly starting to see that gentrification. We're starting to see the impact of Gen Z in the marketplace. We define Gen Z as 18 to 28 years old. And we're starting to see baby boomers really starting to leave the market. You know, the youngest baby boomer is turning.
Some of them are leaving in a box, unfortunately. But,
yeah. Okay. Well, that was the thing, right? Is that when we talk about consumers leaving the marketplace, we don't mean they're dying. We just mean they're not buying new cars anymore. So, but you know, the baby boomer effect, which, you know, has gone on for decades, is really starting to fade. And it's a very, very interesting evolution that we're seeing in the market.
And we've seen the manufacturers kind of alter their mix, given on what they could build or what they wanted to build. And certainly they wanted to build high profit cars, which are typically more expensive vehicles. And that's kind of pushed the market way up and I think pushed new cars out of the reach of many buyers, right?
It has. The surveys that we've conducted recently on the site show that about half of consumers are planning on spending around $30,000 or less on a new car. And the problem is only about 12% of new cars are priced under $30,000. Now, there are some good cars out there, the Honda Civic, the Jeep Compass, the Kia Seltos. There are some vehicles out there that are very competitive that are also competitively priced. But we are certainly seeing that, you know, the price of vehicles has risen tremendously in the last few years. And so that's caused a real challenge, you know, for affordability for consumers. I think that, you know, fortunately, there's tools that you can use, like a shop by payment tool, to calculate how much you can pay or what you want to spend, how much you can expect to pay, that I think will help consumers even before they go to the dealership.
Yeah. One of the things I recommend is people look at late model used cars as a substitute for a new car. I mean, that typically wasn't the case. I mean, typically people were either a new car buyer or a used car buyer, and maybe the smart money was always on used cars. But these days, I think there is more substitution or potential substitution. I think we found that during COVID when people were essentially, they couldn't find a new car and they had to buy a used one. But what's your take on that? That's challenged, of course, by the fact that we weren't building as many new cars over the course of the last 2 or 3 years, as you just mentioned. Talk about that, would you?
Absolutely. What we're finding is that there's a real shortage of 1 to 5 year old cars, that 10 million units that I talked about earlier. But that does mean that if you are trading in a 1 to 5 year old vehicle, you could get as much as 23% more than you would have gotten as a trade-in in 2020. So the vehicle is worth more, and it certainly is worth considering trading in. Again, you can go online, find out what that vehicle is worth. You can get an instant offer and know whether you want to just take the cash or whether you want to go through the trade-in process. But that vehicle is definitely, especially if it's 1 to 5 years old, you got some nice features on it, it's in good condition, you can really get recoup some good funding, good money on that.
Yeah, if you're coming to the end of a 3-year lease too, I would check to see what the residual value in the contract is, because you might find that you could buy that vehicle under market, under what it's worth in the market, and do well, either by keeping that vehicle or buying it and then turning it around and selling it.
Absolutely. It's funny you should say that, because my lease is up next month. and
you're going to say goodbye to Sergio? I can't believe that.
No, I'm going to keep him. Despite driving back and forth across the country 3 times, it actually is worth more than I owe on it. And so I am going to buy it. But I will tell you that I'm going to really look carefully at minimizing my interest payment on it, because of course, anytime that you purchase a vehicle after you leased it, I've already spent quite a bit on interest on that product. So I want to try and get the shortest amount of loan possible and really pay the least amount of interest possible so that I can really minimize that total cost of the vehicle when it comes, especially when it comes to interest. So I'm looking at that carefully. I was doing some math even just last night on how much to put down, how much to take out, you know, what I really want to get a loan for. But it absolutely is worth more. The mileage is very low on it, even though I've driven it so much across the country. I don't drive much every day anymore. So absolutely, if you're leasing, you should definitely consider purchasing that vehicle. Just make sure that you're keeping an eye on your loan.
Yeah, I think if people have not been in the market for 4 or 5 years, they might be absolutely shocked with the interest rates that they're facing now for a car loan versus what they faced the last time, right?
Absolutely. So we've got two factors. We've got the price of the vehicle itself, and we've got the cost of money. And interest rates have gone up. And so I do have to tell people that you need to be careful when it comes to your payment. What you don't want to do is extend out like 84 months, you know, or get a super long, because you're going to be underwater on that vehicle. So you do want to, you know, you don't want to overspend. Part of that joy that we talked about at the beginning comes from being able to afford the vehicle and having that feeling that, you know, you're not car poor, just like you don't want to be house poor. You don't want to be car poor either.
All right. Do you think the industry is going to respond to the fact that there are so few under $30,000 vehicles and maybe give us some more action there, some more models to choose from in that price range? Or is that just kind of gone for good?
You know, I think that if they listen to advice, I think that they should, because think of the generations that are coming in, the cohorts that are coming into the marketplace. We found that Gen Z actually is purchasing their new car, their first car earlier than millennials did. And I think part of that is, you know, millennials, when they started to think about new vehicle purchase, we had Uber, Lyft, we had car sharing, ride sharing, we had all these new things that were going to replace personal mobility. We have now found, you know, 15 years later that that's not the case. And so I think that for Gen Z, they're saying, no, I need the practicality of having my own vehicle. So I think that we need to consider who is coming into the marketplace, the additional debt that they have from things like student loans, and consider the fact that if we are going to get people into a new car, they do have to be realistic. They have to be attainable, and not through really long loans, but rather through just good value, good pricing.
Yeah. I would think Gen Z would be a prime market for electric vehicles, except for one thing, and it's affordability, right? I mean, certainly I would think they have the mindset to really favor electric vehicles, but we haven't seen any kind of real mass market adoption of electric vehicles at all, have we?
We really haven't. And while we do see interest on the site, we do on cars.com, people are searching for electric vehicles. About twice as many are actually searching for hybrids and plug-in hybrids. So they're interested in the technology. They're interested in plug-in technology. But I think at the end of the day right now, we still have a lot of concerns when it comes to charging anxiety. It's less about range anxiety. And it's always been about charging anxiety. But now we have really fantastic vehicles that have plenty of range. And the concern is, once that battery is drained, where do I charge it? I think a plug-in hybrid is a really good transitional vehicle where you have EV range, and then you also have the perceived safety net, if you will, of a gas engine. So I think that's why we're seeing a lot of interest in hybrids and in plug-in hybrids.
Yeah. And when we come back, we'll have more with Rebecca Lindland of Cars Commerce. So stay with us. We'll be right back right here on America on the Road. Welcome back to America on the Road with Chris Teague. This is Jack Neared with you. Thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate it. And let's continue with our interview with Rebecca Lindland of Cars Commerce. Let's go to that right now. It seems like the regulators, though, and governments are not very hot about plug-in hybrids, about anything with any kind of combustion engine. Talk about that, would you?
Well, yes. And this is, you know, an area I've spent a lot of time in the EV space. I've spent a good amount of time in the environmental space as well. So I think that the challenge really is we don't have a fully appropriate substitution for gas engine. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges. The infrastructure for charging is not there yet. It's not fully developed yet. And we have a lot of work to do in that regard. On the positive side, just as range has increased dramatically, charging time has decreased dramatically, especially when you think about level three chargers. But of course, people aren't going to have level three chargers in their home, but you don't have a gas station in your home either. So I think that as we migrate towards putting in level three chargers at more and more locations, I think that then the people will become more comfortable with electric vehicles.
Well, good advice. Good advice. And Rebecca Lindland, it's so great to talk to you. I always enjoy it. You, of course, are the Auto Data and Insight Director at Cars Commerce, part of Cars.com. Yeah. Thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it. Love to talk
to you. Excellent. Thank you so much. Look forward to being on again.
And that was our interview with Rebecca Lindland of Cars Commerce. Our thanks to Rebecca for being with us. I invite people to check out my newest book, Dance in the Dark. It's a crime thriller. It's available on Amazon. And if you like America on the Road, please pass it on. Let people know what station you're listening to the show on. You can certainly pass along a podcast, can't you, Chris?
You absolutely can. If you do a quick Google search, you can find America on the Road on any of the major platforms. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart Radio, and many, many others. So we are hard to miss.
Yeah. So pass it on if you like. Like it if you'd like. And give us a 5-star review if you feel the urge. We would appreciate that. If you subscribe to America on the Road, we'll be forever grateful. Chris will come by and bake you a small cake, maybe a cupcake or something like that. But thanks very much for being with us on America on the Road, for staying with us, and join us again next time for another edition of America on the Road. I got this letter from a reader the other day, and I thought I'd share it with you. I'm on vacation on the beach in Key Biscayne and just finished reading Dance in the Dark. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Great plot and twists I never saw coming. You're really good at creating visual images. Congrats, you made my vacation all that more enjoyable. This is just the kind of feedback an author loves to hear. I'm Jack Neared, host of America on the Road and the author of Dance in the Dark, a crime novel inspired by true crime. Many have told me that Dance in the Dark has all the realism of Fatal Photographs, my true crime account of the famous bathing suit model murder case. That's great to hear because Dance in the Dark is filled with suspense, plot twists, and surprises, but at the same time, it's a believable story in the tradition of writers like James M. Cain, Jim Thompson, and Elroy Leonard. Dance in the Dark is available in paperback and Kindle ebook form from Amazon.com, and it's available direct from the publisher emlancey.com as well. If you have a chance, please look for it. If it makes your vacation better, we'll both be happy. That's Dance in the Dark by Jack R. Neared at Amazon.com or emlancey.com. Thanks for giving it a look.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.